Now this Sunday, as last Sunday, is a kind of one-off sermon, both to do with Easter. The original plan was that John Stott would take not only last Sunday night's sermon, as he did, but also this Sunday. But then other events overtook us. And it's my privilege to speak on one of the most memorable passages in the whole of the Bible. It's a great privilege to do so. It's Luke chapter 24. I invite you to turn to it in the Bibles there that you've got in front of you. Grab the Bible. Help the preacher. We're going to look at several sentences in that scripture reading. It's a great help to me if we can feel that we are building the sermon together. We're building the study together. Luke chapter 24. And why don't I start on page 86 there with looking at verse 32 about the two travellers on the road to Emmaus. They said to each other, did not our hearts burn within us while he talked to us on the road, while he opened to us the scriptures? If anyone were ever to ask me, did you see Cunningham's comet when it was visible from the earth some decades ago, I'm not quite sure how I should reply. I was a little boy at the time, living in East Africa. My parents took my younger brother and me in our pajamas out under the stars to see the comet. Did I see the comet? Well, I suppose I must have seen the comet because my eyes scanned the whole of the African night sky above me in response to my parents' encouragement to look for the star with the tail. But for the life of me, I could not recognize it. It was very embarrassing and very galling to me because I could hear my younger brother, Michael, chirping excitedly, I can see it. Well, where? I said, where? Look, they said, it's just there. They pointed very, very carefully to me. Can you see it? And I heard my brother chirp again, I can see it. So finally I lied. Yeah, I said, I can see it. Yeah. And with that we went back to bed. Well, it's possible I saw it all right, but I'm afraid I never did recognize or identify that historic comet. Here's a remarkable story from the Gospels, unique to Luke alone. It's got all the hallmarks of a first-hand witness. It traces this seven-mile journey on the part of two people. Two people who spent the entire afternoon of the first Easter day in the presence of Christ, fresh from his triumph over death, seeing him, talking with him, but not really identifying him or recognizing him until the final moments of their meeting. How could such a thing happen? Actually, this was characteristic of the resurrection appearances. We were hearing last Sunday night of Mary in the garden where Christ's tomb was situated, and how that she failed to recognize the Lord until he called her in the familiar way, Mary. The 11 in the upper room thought at first that the risen Christ among them was some kind of an apparition. In John 21, verse 12, with that wonderful post-Easter lakeside breakfast, none of the seven who were there, we read, dared even to ask the stranger on the shore, who are you? But evidently the question was there in their hearts for a period. Who is he? They didn't like to ask. So it is here in Luke 24, on the road to Emmaus, Easter Sunday afternoon. And the two disciples, neither of them particularly prominent in the group of disciples, But they would have met with Jesus. They would have seen him. They would have heard him. Only one of them is named, Cleopas. It's not possible to identify today where Emmaus was. There are three possible sites that the archaeologists talk about. It doesn't really matter. But the account here is invaluable to us readers. We learn about Christ. We learn about his attitude. We learn about his messiahship. We learn about the power of the scriptures. We learn of what is most important in the reassembling of a worldview which has become shattered to pieces. Because the 7 mile journey that begins here in Luke 24 verse 13 is taken initially with a very heavy tread indeed. It starts with what I call the broken centre and the dashed hopes. Geographically, Jerusalem was to have been the centrepiece of all that Jesus' disciples had been taught to expect. It was going to happen at Jerusalem. The directions had all been in that way, towards Jerusalem. Their early journeys were to end up at Jerusalem. You remember how Jesus was saying to the disciples when Peter first acknowledged him, "You are the Christ, Son of the living God." Then he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer, must go to Jerusalem. Peter didn't want to have anything to do with Jerusalem. He was scared of what might take place there. But nevertheless, Jerusalem was the place. The expectation was building up. The transfiguration and that marvelous mountaintop event in Luke 9 and verse 30, Moses and Elijah are seen to join our Lord and conversing with him about what Luke calls the exodus that he was to accomplish at Jerusalem. He's talking about the great saving event at Jerusalem. It was later to be from Jerusalem, of course, that the news of the kingdom was to be proclaimed to the whole world in ever-widening circles, Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and the rest of the world. All had apparently ended in disaster at Jerusalem. So it was a broken power center of the kingdom of Christ, seemingly. And then we can also speak of the broken center in terms of the death of the central kingly figure, the whole of the gospel adventure. For 3 years, it was he who had held that tiny band together through thick and thin, in journeyings, in storms, crowds, through opposition, in the face of disease and death, right up to the arrest. And now, gone. Take away the dominant figure at the center of an organization, and you can expect the movement to crumble pretty quickly. It had happened only a few years before, in the case of Judas, some kind of messianic imposter, mentioned in Acts chapter 5, verse 36. Judas had had a pretty sizable following too, numbering about 400 people, in fact. But when he was killed, the whole bunch of followers melted away. There'd also been a leader called Judas the Galilean at the time of the census. Same thing happened. When he was removed by death, the movement was decimated. So in Acts chapter 5, the Pharisee Gamaliel remembers these incidents and he relates them and uses those incidents to discourage his fellow Jews from persecuting the new Christian movement. "Don't worry," he was saying. "This movement, if it really is leaderless and without God's power in it, will fall by itself. You've only to wait. Don't persecute it." Well, he was a wise man with an understanding of the pattern of history. Think of John the Baptist and his followers who came to the fore with such strength in those early days of the gospel. But once John was gone, the movement dispersed. And here are two disciples on the road to Emmaus, traveling not to Jerusalem. They're traveling away from Jerusalem. As far as they're concerned, their leader is dead. He's been removed. The scattering process has already started. It began on that fateful Thursday evening of the arrest when, as we read, the disciples forsook Jesus and fled. This is part of the same process. We do realize, everybody, don't we, that without Christ's historic and bodily triumph over death, a few happy memories wouldn't have been enough to keep the organization together, not even for a few hours. The world would never even have heard of Jesus, but for the epoch-making event of a literal resurrection. Jesus earlier, shortly before his arrest, in Matthew 26:31, had quoted from Zechariah. "It is written," he said, "I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered." Now it is happening, apparently irrevocably. So let's go home, back to Emmaus. Forget Jerusalem. Jerusalem is no longer the place for us. The center of the entire kingdom operation, Jerusalem and Jesus together, have absolutely come apart for us. So the dream is over. The broken center and the dashed hopes. It was a dismal and, I suspect, a slow journey for Cleopas and his anonymous companion. But this is the glowing account, in fact, of the entire rebuilding of a worldview, of the doctrinal, theological understanding of what it's all about. Indeed, of who is behind this whole world, what it's all meant for. All that had come apart since Thursday and Friday of the week previous. Now it is to be rebuilt in a different way. Let's look a bit more at the anatomy of this, because it affects us too. So first of all, the broken center and the dashed hopes. But move on to the enduring scriptures and the burning hearts. A figure falls into step with the two trudging companions. He halts them in their tracks with his opening question, verse 17. "What is this conversation which you're holding with each other as you walk?" It says, "And they stood still, looking sad." This is turning out to be a pretty slow journey. It's Cleopas who acts as spokesman here in verse 18. "Then one of them named Cleopas answered to him, 'Are you the only visitor to Jerusalem who does not know the things that have happened there in these days?' And then the stranger says to them, 'What things?'" It was like the pressing of a button. It was like the turning of a tap. It was like the uncorking of a bottle. The story just pours out of them. And can we make sense of their state of mind? Yes, I think we can. The major event, of course, in their minds was the death of Jesus. And that event, his death, could still allow for a worldview that recognized him as a prophet. And they call him that here in verse 19. After all, prophets traditionally underwent persecution, sometimes in Jerusalem, right to the point of death itself. That often happened to prophets. But what, in their viewpoint, the crucifixion of Jesus did not allow was his role as Messiah. There it is in verse 21. Do you see it? Have a look. "But we had hoped," it's in the past tense, "we had hoped that he was the one, to redeem Israel, to be our liberator, our long-awaited rescuer and Messiah." Then, to confuse their thinking still more, were these reports. Well, they were reports of a report that Jesus was alive. They've already dismissed the reports, emanating, as they understand, from women whom they were prejudiced not to believe at that time. A vision of angels, verse 23, who said that he was alive, that him they saw not. So it's reports of a report and rumors, and that's what we've heard. Then the hard facts of the case, you see, as they understand it, verse 24, there it is. "Some of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but him they did not see." So here we are then, on our way home to Emmaus. You see, Mr. Stranger, he couldn't have been the long-awaited Messiah after all. No wonder you see us sad. Our whole world has come apart. Then the stranger begins to speak. We know who he is. But they haven't fathomed it yet. He speaks very boldly to them in his reproach of their slowness to believe the prophets of old. Or rather, if you look at verse 25 closely, their slowness to believe all that the prophets had spoken. It wasn't that Cleopas and his friends hadn't read or believed the Old Testament scriptures. It was that they'd read them selectively, choosing those little bits that spoke of a triumphant Messiah who would be king over his enemies, who would be victorious. Those bits they fastened onto and they believed strongly. But the other passages that spoke of a suffering Messiah had evidently not made sense to them at all. They'd skipped those bits. It didn't add up. And the stranger says to them, let me fill in for you the picture and those awkward bits. Let's look at them. Now they're walking again. And I suppose it must have been one of the most wonderful walks ever undertaken in history. They'd never forget it. Later on, they would tell Luke about it firsthand. Unless, of course, as John Wenham suggests in his book, Easter Enigma, Luke himself might have been the companion of Cleopas. It was etched into their memories always. Later on that evening, after the great moment of recognition, they exclaimed to each other in verse 32. Again, look at it. This is where we started. Did not our hearts burn within us while he talked to us on the road, while he opened to us the scriptures? What happened to make their hearts glow as they walked along? Why, it was that the picture began amazingly to fit after all. Those awkward bits about the suffering servant in Isaiah became part of the photo fit. They'd been expecting a conquering king. They recoiled from the idea of a suffering servant. Now those two figures are seen to coalesce and become one figure under the tuition of their friendly Bible coach on the road. The Messiah is the suffering servant. The suffering servant is the Messiah. And he came to suffer. He had to suffer. It was planned this way. So the death of the man of Galilee in Jerusalem was by no means an obstacle to his being the Messiah. Why, it was the very way by which God's plan of redemption universally was to be achieved. And Jesus must have taken those two baffled disciples through all the teaching about the Passover, what it meant, what it would mean in the future, about the Exodus, how it was a foreshadowing of the great deliverance that God would effect universally worldwide for those who believed in Jesus. Jeremiah's prophecies about a new covenant. Jesus would certainly have been teaching about that. Psalm 22, I bet he quoted that. How they parted my garments among them. For my clothes they cast lots. All of that of the suffering innocent person. Isaiah 53, the sufferer, with his stripes we are healed. He would have gone to that. The book of Leviticus, which to the Jews of old was the book of salvation, telling how through sacrifices we could be put in a right state with God, and how now finally the perfect sacrifice had come. Gradually helping those friends on the road to build up a new framework of belief altogether. And if it's happened once, it's happened millions of times around the world ever since. Old prejudices falling away, blind spots being removed, until the heart begins to glow within. And it's the old, old scriptures that do it. Those consistent, enduring scriptures that do it for a man or woman. They've done it for you. Of course they have, and for me. For girls and boys of 5, 6, and 7 years of age, the same thing can happen. Happens in Sunday schools. Happened to my sister when she was aged 10. The photo began to fit. And note that it wasn't even the remarkable experience of recognition in verse 31 that's at the forefront of their minds as they recollect the events of that amazing afternoon. You'd have thought that they would have said, what an amazing thing. Our hearts are so full. We've seen him. They don't say that. At the forefront of their mind is, didn't our hearts burn within us while he taught us from the Bible? The Bible just lived. That was the experience for them of that Easter Sunday afternoon. No, what our Lord was doing for those two, what he'd been doing earlier that morning for Mary when he told her gently, don't cling on to me because I'm shortly going to be ascending to my Father. Even then he was beginning to educate her as to how to manage when, as living and ascended Lord, he was no longer there in his visible presence. That's what he was doing here in Luke chapter 24. So instead of saying to them, as he met them at the Emmaus Road, you see, it's me, I'm Jesus, risen from the grave. He didn't do that. You might say, why did he not do that? They weren't ready for it. The revelation of his identity would come later, but what they first needed was to rebuild that shattered worldview, to build it up again in a new way, rebuild the picture of messiahship and of the kingdom and of what it meant. So their mistake had been to assume that the death of Jesus was faithful to his claims of messiahship. Patiently, he builds up all over again and shows them that the crucifixion wasn't faithful to those claims. No, the crucifixion confirmed those claims. It provided the very gateway to his entering into his glory, his offer of salvation to all who believe. Their hearts are beginning to glow. The picture is fitting. They're saying to themselves in their own consciences and minds, I didn't realize it had to be. A new picture is forming in their minds. And then, they reach Emmaus. They can't let him go. Verse 29, stay with us. Or in the old version, abide with us. Out of which that old hymn comes that we shall sing at the end of our service. Abide with us, for it is towards evening. The day is now far spent. And of course that leads to a wonderful sequel to the journey. The broken center and the dashed hopes. The enduring scriptures and the burning hearts. Lastly, the familiar action and the opened eyes. They needn't have asked him in. Jesus would never have forced his presence upon them in their home. He's ready to move on. But they say, stay, abide with us. Their minds have been won over. They invite him to stay for supper. The bread's on the table. The moment for disclosure has come. How does he do it? Well, in the case of Mary, the familiar calling of her name was enough. That voice, she recognizes who he is. Now it's the action that they'd either seen before, if they'd been at the breaking of the bread, you know, when the feeding of the 5,000 took place, or maybe they heard others speak of it. They'd been with the 12. They knew who the 12 were. Those hands had broken bread at the feeding of the 5,000. They'd broken bread at the Last Supper. It is a familiar action. At the breaking of the bread, suddenly they look at him in a fresh way. This is the person we've known. This is the person we've journeyed with. This is the person why we've eaten tilapia fish with him on the shores of Galilee. And such hands. Hadn't really noticed the scarred hands of the stranger before. Suddenly, they're looking at him with a new look, a new perception. The guest who had become host in their own place, who is now breaking the bread, as though he was the master of the house. That action, those hands, and in an instant, they knew him. And in an instant, he was gone. Gone just because their eyes had been opened. That was the reason. It was all part of the education of the next 40 days before Christ's bodily presence left this world. The lesson of how to manage without his bodily presence from now on, and to see it as an advantage, in fact, that he has gone bodily from us and has sent his unseen spirit into the lives of all who trust in him. And that we have the scriptures with us. A great advantage, the New Testament. Well, they'd learnt their lesson on the road. That was when their worldview had begun to come together properly. It was the scriptures that did it. No word of disappointment. Oh, he's gone. Not at all. Instead, didn't our hearts burn within us while he walked with us on the road, while he opened to us the scriptures? And so quite suddenly their world has come together again, just as yours and mine does, when we've taken in enough of the scriptures to understand that the account of Christ, the Messiah of the whole world, is historically and universally true for every man and woman, boy and girl, on this whole world. That the picture fits. Nothing would ever be the same again. So they are up on their feet. The broken pieces of bread. What happened to the broken pieces of bread? I think they left them on the table. They were to stay there, I think, uneaten. Back to Jerusalem. That's where we're going. In a strange way, Jerusalem had become important again. Christ's world mission was to be launched from there. They were not going to miss out on the action. They were going to go straight back, 7 miles, back to the assembly, the reassembling group of the other disciples, back to the once broken center of all that they believed in. There's a new center to their thinking now, a new world view altogether. It's a wonderful thing when it happens to somebody. It's a revelation. This is the person who's been waiting for me all my life. This is the person who's been beckoning me to follow him all my days, even though I didn't know it, even though I kept him at arm's length. Sometimes people come to us from some other world view, some other religious way of looking at life. They say, I never realized, but now he's died for me. He's concerned for me. I own him as my Messiah, my Lord. I recognize him as such. The road from Emmaus to Jerusalem was the very same road that they now trudged back on. But were they trudging or running? The same boulders, the same twists and turns in the road. In one sense, nothing had changed. But in another and eternal sense, everything had changed. The journey seemed a different journey back to Jerusalem. The two travelers together with millions of others of us had entered into a new world of informed faith where the picture at last satisfactorily fits. Let's have a prayer. Almighty and eternal Lord, when we take in what you have done in Jesus Christ, when we take in more fully who he truly is, we feel that we could face anything. We go into this new week. Some of us go into a new situation. Very grateful indeed that as we face unknown things, he does come with us, accompanying us, helping us, instructing us. We thank you for the scriptures that make our hearts to glow and burn. We thank you for the fellowship that Christ has brought into being worldwide. Govern and guard our fellowship here. Keep us together and united in him who was dead and is truly, historically, bodily, alive forever. And help us to live our lives as those disciples from then on did, though not seeing him, loving him with an everlasting love. We ask this for his name's sake.
Amen.